The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Rotten Tomatoes is Wrong. I am merely Mark Ellis, and I'm thrilled to have Jacqueline Coley, my co-host, on the show as she is every week, not just because she's great, but because Jacqueline gets to talk to goats, man. Jacqueline, you just interviewed the Williams sisters, and oh, by the way, Will Smith was there too.
Yeah, it is not a bad Sunday. If you're gonna work on a Sunday, talking to the two greatest tennis players to ever grace this planet is not a bad way to go. And they were lovely. It was such a great opportunity. I am so grateful to the folks at Warner Brothers because they are executive producers of the new film, King Richard, which we will not have to be finding out if is Rotten Tomatoes wrong about, because it is totally beloved by everyone that's seen it so far. It's a great film and they were so lovely to talk to.
Oh, I want it to be good.
Yeah, it's really good. And Mark literally... Mark likes me, ladies and gentlemen, but he never texts me as quickly as he did after he saw that post. Like, if there was ever a time.
I couldn't because I saw it on a Sunday, and I also saw what happened to your football team on Sunday. So I wanted to let you be in your own space, and I thought maybe you set up that interview just because you knew what was going to happen. But that's a conversation for a different day. If we're talking about the greatest of all time in a sport, I would say Venus is the greatest tennis player. Excuse me, Serena is the greatest tennis player that ever lived, but Venus is way up there. And if you're looking at shark movies, Jacqueline, then maybe Serena Williams, if she's the Jaws,
yeah,
I will get there, then maybe Venus is the Deep Blue Sea of tennis players, because that's the movie we're talking about today. That's the point of this diatribe, is that Deep Blue Sea is our movie, and we have a very special guest who stars in the film as Dr. Susan McAllister. Saffron Burrows is going to be joining us here in just a little bit. Deep Blue Sea came out in 1999, and it's rotten. It's that rotten movie where it's like Spaceballs. It just needs a few more reviews to be fresh. It's 59% on the tomato meter. And even more curious is the 39% rotten audience score. I don't get that at all because, well, we'll talk about our feelings about the movie when Saffron joins us. But Jacqueline, if you want to tell us what Deep Blue Sea is about, I guess now would be the time to do it. I know there's sharks. Anything else we need to know?
I mean, that's pretty much it, but I will go ahead and give us a quick breakdown. So Deep Blue Sea is the story of these genetically modified Mako sharks, which are being genetically engineered by this pharmaceutical company out in the middle of the ocean. And essentially what it is Saffron Burrows' character. She's a doctor who is hell-bent on trying to find a cure for Alzheimer's. It is something that she holds near and dear to her heart. Samuel L. Jackson's company is funding her endeavors, and they have been getting a ton of bad press because a couple of the sharks has escaped. And along for the ride to sort of wrangle these sharks, they have their shark wrangler, played by Thomas Jane, and an entire ensemble cast of both doctors, researchers, and also their chef, Preacher, played by LL Cool J. And needless to say, you can't have a shark movie without the likelihood that the sharks may escape. And essentially, where these guys are located at is slowly sinking after a horrific plane crash, because they've been told if they can't get these sharks to be harvested, they're about to shut everything down. Revelations come out that make us realize that these sharks are smarter than the raptors in Jurassic Park, and they are coming for the humans as they try to find a way to make it to the surface and escape. And we sort of follow them along their underwater adventure of trying not to get eaten by sharks. LL Cool J is there for his great quips. Lots of people get eaten. And Chalice Jane is wet, along with everyone else for most of the story. So, win in my book.
It's a huge win on multiple fronts. And it's a win for the audience here. Even if you haven't seen Deep Blue Sea, look, I'm going to tell you to pause this and go watch it. And I might say that again later, but like, you can listen to our conversations. We're going to spoil everything. We're going to talk about the big surprise scenes and, oh my God, I can't believe that happened. We're going to get into this with Saffron Burroughs, but I think you can listen to it and then you can go watch Deep Blue Sea later and still have a great time watching it. I'm just saying there's a whole lot of carnage to enjoy. So without further ado, we're going to go to Tim Ryan, who's our expert review curation manager here at Rotten Tomatoes. Tim is going to be telling us what the critics were saying about this movie way back in 1999 when it was released that summer. So, Tim, have at it.
2 minutes with Tim.
When it comes to sharktastic entertainment, nearly everyone can agree that if Jaws represents the pinnacle of the form, and if Sharknado is the subgenre at its campiest, then Deep Blue Sea is smack dab in the middle. And the middle is where the critics found themselves as well. Some enjoyed it as a fun action flick with a sense of humor, while others derided it as a substance-free knockoff of other, better monster movies. Deep Blue Sea is rotten at 59% with 113 reviews, and it has a 39% audience score. So what did the critics have to say? In a rotten review, Keith Phipps of the AV Club wrote, "Deep Blue Sea, a sort of cross between Aliens without the thrills and the Poseidon Adventure without the camp compensations, doesn't deliver the killer shark versus A-list character actor thrills you crave." In a fresh review, David Starrett of the Christian Science Monitor wrote, "It's just the thing for moviegoers wanting violent adventure, split-second editing, and enough water-drenched cinematography to make Titanic look parched." The Rotten Tomatoes critics' consensus reads, "Deep Blue Sea is no Jaws, but action fans seeking some toothy action can certainly do, and almost certainly have done, far worse for B-movie thrills." So that's Deep Blue Sea. And if you're interested in a movie that's this movie's exact opposite in every way, I suggest The Deep Blue Sea, starring Rachel Weisz in a certified fresh drama with zero sharks and a whole lot of heartbreak. Back to you, folks.
Well, thank you for that alternative to the shark movie with The Deep Blue Sea, Tim. Look, it's easy to Monday morning quarterback these things, especially when it's, you know, over 20 years later, but can't we just have some fun with some sharks? We're about to have some fun right now with our special guest. Let's bring on the one, the only, Saffron Burroughs. And as promised, the star of Deep Blue Sea, Saffron Burroughs, is joining us. Not just that, you can currently catch her in season 3 of the hit Netflix show You, stage, screen. You recently played Jackie Kennedy at the Annenberg Center for the Performing Arts. You've done it all, Saffron, but now we get to sort of look at your career full circle and go back to that sweet, sweet shark movie that is somehow not quite fresh on the tomato meter. First of all, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a big deal, not just for Jacqueline and I here and for a lot of our listeners, but our researcher who puts together all these great statistics and interviews from the past, from Deep Blue Sea for this episode, Mark Hoffmeyer. Not only is he the biggest Deep Blue Sea fan on earth, he actually has a podcast dedicated to breaking down and talking about Deep Blue Sea. And so he's a lifer. He is really, really excited about this. And I do have a couple questions from that, Mark, that I want to get into. But first off, I want to start with the question that everybody gets asked when they join the show, because it's called Rotten Tomatoes is Wrong. So it's 59% rotten on the tomato meter, and it's 39% rotten audience score. Saffron, is Rotten Tomatoes wrong about Deep Blue Sea?
So I could make a case for it. Having rewatched it recently, I was impressed with the pace of it from the start. I watched it with a friend yesterday and who hadn't really seen it. And they were, you know, in the first 10 minutes, a lot happens and you meet these characters. I love the ensemble nature of it. Obviously, there's wonderful actors there. Some last longer than others on screen. But the pace of it is, it's, I think that holds up. That stands the test of time. So, and also the, I mean, I love a film where you, in the first 20 minutes, get to know people, you get little snippets of people's lives and histories. And there's a life they create there. You know, obviously there's a community that is really enjoyable. And the first act of pure violence doesn't happen immediately. So you're kind of in this kind of glorious, just here we are meeting people thing, and then boom. So I was pleased that it seems to stand up. It was made quite a while ago, and it's pretty exciting still, I think. There's some things that surprised me watching it again. There's quite a bit of religion there from LL Cool J's character. And by the end, he has us all pretty much, you know, praying for our lives. But yeah, there's some things that stand up. I was curious to see, you know, a lot of films from 20 or 30 years ago have a sort of inbuilt sexism that just wasn't questioned then.
Mm-hmm.
And things I loved as a kid, I look at now, wow, that was pretty full of stereotypes, you know. I think they try to avoid too many of those in this. I'd love your thoughts. What do you think?
I mean, I'll leave it to Jacqueline first, but we did mention in our little pre-show warm-up when Jacqueline and I were talking to the audience that Jacqueline and I love to talk about the movie in depth, and so our audience knows that we're probably going to be spoiling it, but we're reiterating that right now, that we are going to spoil the movie Deep Blue Sea and all of the fun surprises and all that stuff that happens in it. So if you haven't seen Deep Blue Sea yet, again, maybe you want to pause this and then go check it out and then come on back. Jacqueline, it's 59%. Sounds like Saffron thinks it should be fresh. How about you?
Yeah, I mean, it's almost fresh. And it's one of those weird ones, too, where it has an audience to it, but the audience score, I don't think, reflects it, because it is just this gooey camp goodness and also a really, like, taut thriller, too. It mashes up a lot, I think, together. But I think Saffron touched on it. The opening... Look, everyone goes into this movie thinking that it's going to be some either page from whatever of Jaws. Like, that's the ultimate shark movie. And by having that opening, they're like, okay, double the fun. We're going to get two couples. But they subvert the opening of Jaws, where the girl dies and they mm-hmm. actually get saved. And you have Thomas Jane pop in as, like, the ultimate
hero.
Yeah, the ultimate hero. The one thing I will say to it is, look, I had not fully seen this movie until we were getting ready for this. I'd seen most of it, like, through clips, but this is the first time I really sat down, watched the whole thing. And the only thing I have to say is that Colin Trevorrow owes the entire Jurassic World to this movie, because Jurassic World is Deep Blue Sea. Saffron is the Bryce Dallas Howard character. Tom Jane is the Chris Pratt character. They ripped off this movie for $1 billion. And I say that with love. I literally was like, this is Jurassic World. This is Jurassic World.
Wow.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
I don't remember the first time I saw it. I remember renting the movie. I didn't get a chance to see it in movie theaters when it came out in 1999. And y'all opened against some stiff competition. I mean, you still had mm-hmm. Blair Witch Project in theaters. Probably The Phantom Menace and The Matrix were on their last legs. But you had this little horror movie called The Sixth Sense that was coming out around that time, too.
Yes.
And so it was a lot of competition, so I rented it. But I literally do remember sitting in my living room at my parents' place and standing up in shock when that moment with the shark jumping out and just chomping Samuel L. Jackson. And it's like, what the hell just happened? It was one of the cooler moments I've ever seen in a movie, because like you said, the pacing up to that point, it never feels rushed, but it just moves. It's the John Wooden UCLA basketball coach quote, be quick, but never hurry. It moves. But we do get some time to know our characters. And so as I guess my first question, even before we get into like the scenes that still speak to you, your experience when you're making the movie, because it's directed by Renny Harlin. He was coming off a disastrous run with Cutthroat Island. You know, he had some nice hits leading up to Cutthroat Island, and then that happened, and I'm sure was just such a tough break for him in his career. So he's trying to rebound with Deep Blue Sea. There's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of people. There's mechanical sharks. What was it like for you as the lead of a film like that when you were making it?
Well, it was quite a shift. I was in London and Renny had seen me in something, maybe audition for something else. And they said he'd love to meet you, and the studio would love to meet you. So they flew me to LA just for the meeting. Meanwhile, I had some kind of surreal, cliched LA experience as soon as I landed. Some dodgy guy in my hotel invited me to go bareback riding on the beach, which, you know, like every cliche took place the moment I landed. And it was, I went to school in Hackney, and I was from like a strong community of socialists and feminists and activists. And there were these surreal kind of Sunset Boulevard-y things occurring. But I was very drawn to, when I went to meet Akiva Goldsman and Renny, and Akiva's the creator, and he wrote films like A Beautiful Mind. He's a beautiful writer. And then they told me in the room that Sam Jackson and Stellan Skarsgård had already committed to the film. And they were, you know, probably the two actors on screen that I held in the highest esteem at that time, and pretty much still do, you know. So having those two fine people in it already was just thrilling, you know, to sort of tell a story like this, which is obviously intended for a wide audience, and then tell it with really fine actors. And then the ensemble they gathered, I just remember coming away from the meeting thinking, my goodness, that I want to work with those people, you know. It was Aida Turturro and Jackie McKenzie and Michael Rapaport and LL Cool J, who was my hero when I was 11, had his poster on my wall. It was a beautiful ensemble. And I think that's unusual for a sort of an action thriller movie to have such a cast. So that was my main impression. Was I came and met them, and they told me who was in it. And I remember showing up in my kind of little leather shoes and my cardigan, and I read the scene for everybody, and then they said, oh my goodness, we have to scrub you up. So they, you know, put me through this kind of machine of clothes and hair and makeup. I'd never been in a film like that before, you know, where they sort of present you to the studio and say, here she is with a bit of powder on, because I just turned up in my cardigan literally. And it was quite funny, the process of preparing oneself for such a role, for Thomas Jane and I especially, because we just had to do quite a bit of physical labor. You know, it was 6 months of 6 days a week, you know, wake up. There's a kind of a little ritual I told my kids, and they think it's just wild. You know, we shot down in Mexico, you wake up. They had a tanning bed in there that they'd had for Leo DiCaprio for Titanic. So you had to do workout, tanning bed, hair, makeup, all by, you know, 5:30 a.m. or something. So it was like this little boot camp for Thomas and I.
Yeah, it was like a little military operation, because I did read, Jacqueline, this was one of my favorite parts about the research that Hoffmeyer put together for us, is that y'all shot in the same huge water tank that James Cameron had built for Titanic. And so it was a lot of those sets, except this time you have the benefit of every performer's dream with a bunch of mechanical sharks swimming around there too. So being in that tank with the sharks, are the sharks realistic enough that you're actually afraid of them on set? Were you friends with the mechanical sharks? Were they better behaved than the one Bruce from Jaws? I mean, what's it like being in a tank with sharks?
You were warned not to sort of break protocol, because they were, ironically, these mechanical sharks were pretty dangerous. They could move fast.
Yeah.
And if you got in the way of them, it wasn't a good idea. So it was, that itself was a little bit perilous. just they were on these tracks, obviously, rushing through the water in certain shapes and, you know, choreographed designs. But they were this huge metal robotic machines that could, you know, you could fall into their path. And that would be a bad way to go, with a mechanical shark taking you down. So we were filming in these tanks which they created for Titanic, and it was built to look as if you're in the middle of the Pacific, not obviously just at the edge of the Pacific, on Baja California, just off the coast. And it was seawater, so it was pretty cold. It was literally just fresh seawater. And then they felt for us because we were cold, so they built a sort of huge hot tub adjacent to the tanks. So between setups, there'd be lighting stuff. We'd all jump into this hot tub and warm up, then get back into this very cold seawater.
I was just going to say, what I've learned from watching behind the scenes of Abyss and also of Jaws is, forget about animals, forget about, you know, any other kind of things on set, children, water is literally Waterworld, The Abyss, Jaws. They all talk about how difficult it is to film with that as a medium because of how unpredictable it is and how it messes everything up. But it seems with this movie, they kind of got it right, because like the joke on Jaws is they called it Flaws because the shark didn't move. Like half of the brilliance of Jaws was because they couldn't get the shark to move very well. And so they kind of had to like pull it in certain ways. So the reason why you never see the shark is because they couldn't get the shark on screen. But these sharks are fairly visible, and it's not just all CGI. So I'm guessing they kind of got them very functional for y'all's filming.
Mm-hmm. They did. I think at the time, other shark experts said that we did good sharks. The little bit I know about sharks, I was supposed to swim with sharks the way Thomas Jane does. I'm officially not allowed to scuba dive, so that didn't happen. I was quite relieved. Thomas is down there, you know, with swimming with sharks, with just a, you know, some metal between them. But I was told our sharks were pretty good.
I read an interview with some marine biologists that said that Mako, the look of the Makos was accurate to a real Mako shark, and it's also the wise choice to make these antagonists to be the smartest shark that is in the water, which is Mako's. And then obviously the genetic engineering, thanks to someone like you in the movie, sort of enhances that even further. But the last thing I wanted to ask you before we actually get into all of our favorite scenes, because there's so many to choose from, is that one of the, I read a story about a test screening that went great, but not necessarily for your character, that there was a test screening and the fans loved it, but the only issue was that the fans said, well, we're not sure that Saffron's character should make it out of this movie.
So they, like, you had to go back to die? Like, this is ridiculous. Like, they literally were like, she has to die. How did you feel when you get that phone call to be like, okay, we need you?
So the first inkling I got that it was not going to go in my character's direction was this test screening in New York. It was actually sort of an audience. It was a public audience, and they were shouting at the screen, expletive, 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 die, you know, asterisk, asterisk.
What?
Every time I showed up, and I thought I was playing this altruistic, rather fantastic person who was doing this groundbreaking research. And then when Sam Jackson came on, this woman shouted out, like, I won't say what she shouted out. It was very sexy and very admiring. And so I realized quickly who were the baddies. And I naively, you know, when you're young and you're playing someone and you want to believe in their goodness, you know. So this screening in Times Square was quite shocking for me. They literally were booing at me as I would pop up on screen. So I did understand why they'd made this change. Originally, we shot a scene where LL Cool J, Thomas Jane, and I survive, and we're in a lifeboat. And Renny Harlin was in a helicopter above us with a camera. And we had walkie-talkies. And at a certain moment, we spot a ship, a huge ocean liner that rescues us. The boys with me got seasick, so they took you know, anti-queasy medicine. It made them very sleepy. So we were in this little blow-up boat with the walkie-talkie, and obviously, you know, it was hidden beneath us, and someone would call out action. And I think both the boys, Thomas and LL, were almost napping because they were so sleepy from this medicine. So we were in this tiny rubber dinghy and I'm kicking and going, action, action. And we do this sequence and Rennie Harlan loves the loudspeaker, a loud halo. So he, even if he's not in a helicopter, he you know, on a on a set like this and a shoot like this, you sort of need a bit of, you know, you need some volume. Mm-hmm. So he liked to call me Safe Cat because that was, he called me Street Cat because that was my rap name when I was a kid. So he nice. Found out that I was a rapper and I was Street Cat and my friend was Street Dog. So he goes, okay, Street Cat, go for it. And then he'd talk you through the scene. And so I was Street Cat for the whole shoot. So there was this rescue scene that we shot. And then, yeah, I got this phone call saying, we don't feel that you should be surviving this. So we've had to go ahead actually and shoot a quick moment with the body double in a pool in LA because we had to do it fast and you're in London. So that's what we've done.
It's almost like you as Saffron Burroughs were going through the same thing that your character was because you thought you were doing good in the movie, but then it turns out that not everyone felt the same way about it. So
you know what's funny though? It is a testament to your acting because I get the altruism, but I think it was that full force altruism and in the wake of the destruction that people couldn't deal with. You know what I'm saying? Like it wasn't, I think, that they dislike you. It was just more like there were so many characters that perished.
Yeah.
They just had to like that, like she's gotta get it too. Like everybody's gone through it. The bird died.
The
bird didn't have anything to do with it.
And I see now, I watch it again, think, wow, she's focused in a way that's alarming for all the other humans on board. There's a blinkered focus that's concerning. The bird.
The poor bird.
You never kill the dog in the movie, but the birds 50-50 at best. So I want to get into some of the scenes that we all love from the movie because we all obviously I also think that Rotten Tomatoes is wrong. It's one of these movies that is right on that line of demarcation. It's 59%. If it was 60%, it'd be fresh. And so I think it deserves to be even higher than that simply because the task at hand, it's like everybody knows that Jaws is the shark movie. So how do you do one that separates itself from Jaws? One of the ways that this does it is you have the surprises, like when Stellan gets his arm bit off or when Sam Jackson gets completely bit in a hole. But one of my favorite scenes in the movie is that horror-like setup where Thomas Jane's character has to swim and he's got to go take care of some stuff, but then the sharks are smart enough to start turning the lights on and off and turning the cameras on and off. And it just becomes this like haunted house, even Paranormal Activity type thing where we don't really know who to trust, but we realize that the sharks are just as smart, if not smarter than us. I mean, I watched the movie again this week and I got chills during that scene all over again. It was just so much fun to watch. And I imagine seeing that in the theater, it's just got to be torturous in the most fun way possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's true. Those moments where they create the notion that they're actually also, they are organizing collectively against the humans. That's really something. When he's in that tunnel and it becomes clear they're attacking simultaneously and the sort of metal tunnel he's swimming through, I think those moments are fantastic. And I'd forgotten how the notion of them planning together and in some way sort of freaking the humans out, and then also recognizing a gun, swimming away from it, swimming backwards, all those incremental buildups they have, I think, very smart, because you assume sharks just go for blood, but they're plotting.
Yeah, it's like your Jurassic World Raptors, Jacqueline.
Yeah, it is very much like that. Abdominus Rex, like it is right there again. Colin Trevorrow, I feel that Rennie has a very good copyright case against him because the blueprint is there. Absolutely, for sure. I don't know. I guess if we're going to talk about scenes real quick, and this is not just because I love him, but like they really gave LL Cool J the hero's arc of this because, like, first of all, the fact that he was the cook, his name is Preacher. He's a man of faith, literally in every aspect of this. You instantly want him to succeed the minute you see him talking to his parrot and the parrot's like eating the frosting off of his finger. Like you immediately, mm-hmm. I'm like, this dude better make it. And mm-hmm. the scene with him in the oven, mm-hmm. as unbelievable as all of that is, it's absolutely ridiculous. I was so there with him in that moment. Mm-hmm. And that's mm-hmm. the reason why, no matter what, even the idea that every other person, when they get in the mouth of the shark, is eaten instantly. But for some reason, LL Cool J like makes it in and then makes it out. Like I don't know how they made that decision that he had to live, but I was very worried because I didn't remember who lived or died in this. And then the minute I saw him like get grabbed by the shark, I was like, no! I was like legitimately upset. So yeah, everything LL Cool J did, but especially the him breaking out of the oven scene and then roasting the shark for all he was worth, it is a fave.
The oven scene is brilliant. Yeah, even though you know it's pretty incongruous, you completely are there with him. I agree. I feel he's the eyes of us, of the audience, not my character. He's the eyes of the audience, and he's so human. And also, he's a civilian. He hasn't caused any of this trouble. He's the chef, so he's completely innocent in the whole situation. And I love that he survives, but I had the same feeling. I thought, wait a minute, doesn't he survive? And then he's got his crucifix out and he's...
It was very horrible. I mean, yeah, he has so many scenes where, again, you're just on the edge of your seat watching it. For you, Saffron, when you go back and watch Deep Blue Sea again, or maybe the first time you got to see the finished film at the premiere, what was the scene that really stuck out to you as far as either something that you genuinely enjoyed watching just as a fan or the one that really got a rise out of the audience?
Well, I love LL Cool J's journey because I think we do see everything through his eyes. I was at a screening last night for Belfast, and a woman came up afterwards and said, why don't we get to find out how he makes the perfect omelet? When are we going to discover that?
Hello. My name is Sherman Dudley. And if this message finds you, then I did not survive, so this is my legacy. I have loved the pulpit, and I have loved the bottle. I did my best to be a good husband, a father. I came up wanting. So what do I have to say to you? What mark do I have to leave behind? We will begin with the perfect omelet, which is made with two eggs, not three. Amateurs often add milk for density. This is a mistake.
So I love that stuff. I mean, particularly memorable in terms of filming was when we're trying to strap Stellan Skarsgård to the sort of gurney and get him onto the helicopter, and these huge waves are spilling over us. I actually got knocked under that night. The guy who was timing the waves, I guess, looked the other way. So
what?
He had these dump tanks of water. It's funny because these things are incredibly sophisticated in many ways. And some of it comes down to just a guy with a cigarette who's dumping tanks of water on you. So just the timing went a little bit wrong and I got knocked under. And Rennie thought I was doing this marvelous sort of underwater acting stuff. And I whacked my head on the metal sort of pier, the jetty that we were walking on. And one of the actors pulled me out, Samuel Jackson pulled me out. And Rennie didn't realize that it was not entirely just me improvising fantastically. So there were kind of these, you know, physical moments on set, I'm sure for all of us, for every actor, and I'm sure for every stunt person, where you feel the elements and what Jacqueline was saying earlier about working with water, where you really feel it. You know, that moment where LL's in the corridor and that water just breaks forth and he's, I mean, most of that, you know, all of that we did, either us or a brave stunt person was there doing it. The Thomas Jane stuff is wild. You know, when we're leaving the laboratory and the water's sort of chasing us up the stairs and he's crashing around and sliding around. And I think, my God, this guy's really... You know, he really went for it in an impressive way.
He is what every guy wants to look like when they get out of the pool, because he's got like 30 shots in this movie where he's just got that, like, he's just coming out of the water and he's just like abs and just pecs for days. And we're all, yeah, that's the guy. That's who you take me to the doctor. You take me to whatever person can just make me over. That's who I want to look like eventually. And he gets a little bit of a hero journey in here too, but it really is. I mean, again, rewatching it, it's LL Cool J's movie. So big shout out to LL Cool J, not just for surviving both this and Halloween H2O, which is both miracles, but he also, have you heard or have you seen the lyrics for his Deepest Blue Sea tune that he did? It's so good. Jacqueline, do you have a favorite quote from Deepest Blue Sea?
Well, first of all, they kept the religious imagery over through the song. And like the second verse is, "Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Killers swarm to beasts, swallowed them in flames." Like, seriously, though? Bars. Straight bars. "Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Killers swarm to beasts, swallow them in flames. They switch my DNA, flip me to Cool J. I can't fight the feeling, I'm forced to kill brains. I love it.
Wow.
Yeah, and he kind of turns into the, like, now he's telling the story from the perspective of a shark. It's real. I highly encourage everybody to not only check that out, but also as far as Deep Blue Sea, there's some great facts about the movie that I've been provided from, again, a guy who literally does a podcast on Deep Blue Sea. The sharks have a ton more screen time than pretty much any other shark movie you'll ever see. 13 minutes and 37 seconds of screen time for the Makos. And I do have a question that our researcher, Mark Hoffmeyer, wanted me to ask you, because he's watched this movie more times than any other human or shark on Earth. And
legit.
He wants to know if you have any insight as to, he wanted to know, why was Ronnie Cox cast in the movie but didn't have any lines? Because Ronnie Cox from Beverly Hills Cop and RoboCop, he's in the movie and he lends that presence to it. But Mark Hoffmeyer was confused as to why he didn't have any lines in the film.
I remember him having lines when we shot it. I remember
enough said.
I remember a conversation. But now I've dipped my toes into the directing world. I see now how every moment needs to earn its keep. And not because an actor's not brilliant, but just because the narrative needs to push forward and push forward. So I now understand a little more, if I do have something cut that I've performed, okay, I see why the story didn't need that. So anyway, that's perhaps lends itself to an explanation, but yes. Just, can I go back to LL on the rapping? Because his track, "I Need Love," I don't know if you remember, "I Need Love." So everyone in my school was just singing that rap when it came out. Yeah. "Is it under the bed?" You know, that one. So so in the evenings, Jackie McKenzie, who's a brilliant actor from Australia, she's a really good cook. So we all lived together in this sort of compound in about 20 minutes from the studio in Mexico. And so Jackie would cook. I don't know what was I doing? Maybe making salad or something. And LL would sit at the table and just write lyrics. And I thought, this is heaven. That was like just a Tuesday evening. It would happen all the time because we only had us. You know, that was our whole community, was just us. And Stellan Skarsgård had, you know, his many children and his wife with him. So that was fun too, because it was like a sort of real family feeling.
But the rest
of us were sort of...
Are you saying Alexander Skarsgård was on set and Bill Skarsgård was on set of Deep Blue Sea?
Oh, yes.
They were like little kids, you know, bobbing in and out of the sea. And yeah.
Who would have thought that one day that would grow up to be Pennywise?
My grandpa lived next door to me and he loved to play rap at 3 a.m. I'd be like, "Listen, I'm a woman. I'm in makeup in a minute. And you haven't gone to bed yet?" So he was so sweet, because when he apologizes, he's adorable. So I'd be knocking on his door in the middle of the night, like, "Listen, I need to sleep for my little 3 hours before I go into the works, this kind of military operation that I have ahead of me." So we had this strange kind of college-like atmosphere with everyone living in these apartments next to each other.
You got to be so busy with all the projects you're working on right now and being a mom on top of it. Do you ever get to catch up with any of the other cast from Deep Blue Sea? Have you ran into LL Cool J recently?
I haven't seen LL for a long time. I see Stellan sometimes and Jackie And Samuel. Yeah, I'd love a reunion. That would be really good.
Well, regardless of what the critics said or the audience score, there's two things you can take from the film. Two of the best reviews about it came from Roger Ebert, the incomparable iconic critic, gave it like a rave review. And also, because it has so many horror elements, not a bad person to like it was a Mr. Stephen King. So I would just say if your fan club is maybe a little bit different than what people expected, the movie made money. It's memorable. You still have people literally last night coming up to you talking about, you know, things from it. I think you can rest in that assumption. And it's funny you mentioned the fact that you dipped your toes into directing, because your film actually premiered in my home city, the Austin Film Festival. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that? Because I'm curious, you know, you've done so many things. Does directing really sort of scratch an itch you're anxious to keep doing? Or how do you feel about it now, having dipped your toe into this pool?
Yes, thank you for that lovely question. I was thinking about it for quite a while. And then a friend came to me, she'd written this piece of work called Everything I Ever Wanted to Tell My Daughter About Men. And it's a woman, it's quite dark. It's a woman who was abused as a kid. And then it's her relationships with men that took place subsequently. Some are funny, some are not so funny. And I directed two of the short films within the feature. So I was very fortunate because I got to offer roles to actors that I know and love. And so Jason Isaacs did one of my shorts with me that went to Austin. And he's a brilliant actor. You guys have probably spoken to. And then because this project was for charity, it was to support survivors of violence and abuse. People just said yes to it, which was really a treat. So I asked Sia to do some music for me and write a song for it, and went to record with her. What a beautiful experience. So I had this fantastic time just on these shorts. And now there's some longer projects that I'm involved with. I'm producing one for a friend of mine. She directed the first feature by a Black British woman 30 years ago. And that's actually my first film that I was in as a teenager. And so now she's come full circle, like she's raised kids and now she's going back to that world of directing. So I'm producing something she's written and directing, which is brilliant, about racism in Los Angeles. And I'm directing myself a couple of other projects I really like that I'm attached to. They're at the beginning stages, financing and finding people. But I was reminded last week, I directed Marianne Jean-Baptiste in a short film. She was brilliant and she turned up and just played this role and I was in heaven. So I was reminded just last week how much I love it, how the thrill of when you have a DP you trust and someone in front of the camera that's very talented and you're shaping it with them, you know, shaping the images together. It's thrilling for me.
It's even more of an honor than that you're here on our show because you sound busy. Like the fact that you had the time to come and talk to us about Deep Blue Sea, it just, I mean, I feel like a great award has been bestowed upon me. First of all, if there's only one person that you follow on the 4th of July, make it Jason Isaacs because he always tweets some joke about his role in The Patriot, which is hilarious. but then Saffron, you also, you're in season 3 of You, which is this monster hit on Netflix. And without, I guess, spoiling the arc too much of what happens in season 3, what can you tell us about your character in that show?
Yes, I play a role I'm reprising from season 2. I'm the mother of Love Quinn, played by Victoria Pedretti. I play Dottie, her mother. And I guess in season 2, you learn a little bit about this world that Love Quinn's come from, which is sort of wealthy hippie world, a little like the characters on White Lotus. When I watched that, it reminded me a bit of the Quins, sort of privileged but pseudo hippie privilege. Mm-hmm. In season 2, you learn a little bit about Dottie and the husband and the wealth, and also the fact that they cover up violence that her daughter's committed without giving too much away. And then in season 3, I'm divorced and I'm in the middle of a breakdown and you know, the beautiful boy who's died, the character's son has died. And so I've got nothing to lose. But I do also think Dottie Quinn believes that her tiny baby grandson is this reincarnation of her son.
Yeah.
So I understand grief, you know, grief takes you in lots of different directions. So what's lovely about the role they've written is she's got nothing left to lose, really, except just there's a couple of things she still can hold on to and care about. So that's sort of what you see. It's a little bit of a Tennessee Williams character. You see her unraveling.
I watched season three, I had it in my preview center and I started it and I finished it a couple weeks ago. And the thing it struck me about it, which is that we've seen mothers like Dottie before, somewhat narcissistic, controlling, and not necessarily it's not that they don't love their daughters. It's just their love comes with a cost. And there's always like a transactional nature to it. But what I found interesting about Dottie is so many oftentimes with these characters, they try to redeem them. They try to, like, you know, in Lady Bird, that mom ends up being a good mom by the end. And I think although Dottie has moments of truth, and moments where she puts herself out there to say to love what she needs to do, I really liked how they did not try to make her into some, you know, misunderstood mother. And she just lived in her truth of, like, you know, not all moms are going to have their, you know, I would say a sitcom happy ending. And this show was okay with living with the fact that, like, no, she's not a horrible person, but she's also not the best mom for this particular person. I'm curious how you felt about being able to portray a character like that. Because again, not irredeemable, but they don't try to redeem her either.
Mm-hmm. I love that they don't try to redeem her. The fact she survives, so many people don't survive that show. Mm-hmm. I love that she survives, and I love that the baby heads in the direction of safety. And they've cast it really well. You know, there's some fantastic actors in this season, and there's some surprising, there's a lot of surprises, but there's an exploration of Silicon Valley and wealth and privilege and all of those things. But it seems that this character is utterly truthful all of the time and lives by her own personal moral compass. And some of it's skewed, but also she's been surviving in a world where the only way when she was a kid to get by was, you know, I worked out a whole background for her, of course, and she came from a rough place and had a difficult start and then married into something that was safety. So she got stitched up early on, I think. And so playing someone who is offensive and unpleasant and aggressive and can be violent and can be prickly and difficult, I embrace that. It's lovely, you know, and I recognize it in humans around me and also have some empathy for her.
Any chance that we get to see Dottie again, possibly in season four?
I hope Dottie shows up in Paris and does something dramatic.
There could be some revenge factors.
Yeah.
Yes. I hope Dottie shows up.
Yeah, not to spoil too much, but if there is anybody that would be looking for Joe in season four, I have a feeling it would be definitely Dottie. So I'm with you on that one. I'll just add this, and it has been great to chat with you today, but I'm not kidding. This is not an easy comedy to get, but this is my Circle of Friends DVD that I've had since 2000. And because this was like a kind of like a box office movie, but also kind of this is like HBO. So like it was mostly on TV. So this is a hard commodity to come by. I've been a fan since then and all the way through with all your stuff from like The Bank Job and Mozart and The Jungle. It was really a treat to chat with you. And I've now forgiven Nan for trying to steal.
I'm so impressed that you have a copy of that.
Yes, really, it's actually a difficult DVD to have, and like it's one of the old ones. And I read that novel too, which the movie is very different from the novel in a lot of ways, but it's still great. So much appreciated.
And everything comes full circle because the one thing I remember about Circle of Friends is seeing the poster outside the movie theater I'd go as a kid. And I remember seeing the name Saffron Burroughs and the name Chris O'Donnell on the movie poster. And Chris O'Donnell and LL Cool J are now in that whatever that NCIS or whatever on CBS together. So Yeah. Everybody runs in the same circle of friends eventually.
Very much so.
I'm so glad you survived the
shark. Isn't that interesting? That I've been thinking about that casting, putting those two together.
But it's brilliant. I mean, that show's like 7, 8 seasons deep. It's very popular. Yeah. And it's not a just whatever show. That is a very popular show. Before you get out of here, though, I know that you're a busy mom and you have a lot of stuff going on, but I also know that you really love film and you're a storyteller. Do you have any recommendations for us for anything that we should be watching or looking out for?
Well, I'm a little slow to things because my youngest is so young. So I literally just watched, for example, A Promising Young Woman, which I thought was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And everything Michaela Cole does, I adore.
Yes. Yeah. I May Destroy You is crazy.
I May Destroy You and her previous work, Chewing Gum. And I did completely binge watch Normal People and Ted Lasso because it's so relaxing. They're so sweet. My God. The idea that masculine toxicity can be softened at the edges and people can learn and grow, you know, it seems to be at the heart of that show. And I love that. And there's so much humor in it. But maybe if you want some more unusual recommendations, my favorite films from the last kind of 20 years are, you know, they're a little more off center, less commercial.
No, those are great ones though too.
Yeah.
And I got a chance to see that movie. You were into a screening last night or recently, Belfast, and that's great too.
Oh, that was beautiful. Belfast, my goodness. Yes, I sort of went to sleep and dreamt about it. I have family in Belfast but it's such a universal film. It's this little boy just seen through his eyes and he's living in a pretty much a war zone and he's 9 and it's just his innocence is crumbling away. It's beautiful.
And that kid is so good. He's so good.
Very good.
I mean, look, that should be a nice lesson to everybody who is a regular listener to our show, our fresh members of the Catch Up crew, that even I, Mark Ellis, can enjoy a movie that A is in black and white and B does not have Mako sharks that are super smart. So if I can do
I'm
it.
I'm so glad.
But you just know, about anyone
actually,
can.
They need to have you on the poster saying that.
That is a quote, ladies and gentlemen.
We should contact Kenneth Branagh about that quote.
Yes, get this quote.
Yeah. All on board. But, you know, a quote you could retroactively put on the poster of the DVD jacket for Deep Blue Sea is the blurb from Stephen King himself, because Jacqueline mentioned Stephen King was a big fan. Stephen King, this was the first movie that Stephen King saw after he almost died. He got hit by a car going for a walk. And he almost died. So Stephen King's quote was, "My first trip out after being smacked by a van and almost killed was to the movies. It was Deep Blue Sea, as a matter of fact. I went in my wheelchair and loved every minute of it." So that is the master of horror giving a big cosign to Deep Blue Sea, as does our expert researcher, Mark Hoffmeyer, has a podcast about Deep Blue Sea. So I'm so glad he got to do his research and inform us, and we got to talk to you. Saffron Burroughs, Dr. Susan McAllister in Deep Blue Sea, and so many other great roles now doing great things behind the camera, producing projects. It was a treat to have you on Rotten Tomatoes Is Wrong. Thank you so much, Saffron.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you both.
All right, Jacqueline, those are the kind of interviews that you love having, because it starts at Deep Blue Sea and it goes to all these different places. But the bottom line is this: you and me need to find a way to go cage diving with sharks. Am I right? Are you in?
No.
Will you hang out on the boat? Just hang out on the boat.
Oh, absolutely. When you get eaten, I want to be able to document it for sure. Absolutely. We wouldn't be friends if I wasn't there for you in that way. But no, I'm not getting in the water. Like what LL Cool J says in this movie about Samuel L. Jackson getting caught in the avalanche, that's the way I feel about all of this. He's just like, brother, what are you doing here? And I'm not going to be that person. I will be there for you in support.
All right, well, you'll be the preacher. I guess I'll be a mix between Thomas Jane and Saffron Burroughs. We're not sure if I'll survive or not, but it was such a treat to have her on. Thank you again to Saffron Burroughs. And make sure y'all check out You Season 3, as well as her film project she's working on. Again, two shorts that premiered in Jacqueline's pretty much backyard, the Austin Film Festival. Indigo and Michael are the names of them. And just a real treat having her on. We love doing a mailbag. We haven't had mailbag in a couple weeks, but don't worry. Keep writing those emails and you can let us know what your comments, what your thoughts on movies we've already talked about, or you can recommend movies that you think that we should be keeping an eye out open for. That email address is rtiswrong@rottentomatoes.com. And as always, you're listening to us in podcast form. You can subscribe or rate, review, whatever your platform of choice encourages you to do. We encourage you to do that as well. And also check out Deep Blue Sea. Jacqueline, next week, I don't even know if we're allowed to say what we have going on next week. We've had to do these vague teases, but it always pays off for the audience because we get some pretty cool guests.
Yes. And I know we will definitely have a certified fresh guest that you guys are going to be very excited to talk to. So that's all I can say. But their selection of their film has not quite been pinned on yet. But needless to say, you should look forward to it. We've had some amazing guests on the podcast recently. It's just a matter of which one's coming out next.
And it might be one of the stars of a hit show on HBO. Okay, said too much.
Might be.
I've overstepped my bounds, so I'll simply say thank you to Saffron Burrows for joining us here on this walk down memory lane, or this swim down memory lane, as it were. Our engineering team here of Brian Perez, producer Lucy herself, the entire squad at Rotten Tomatoes, my co-host, who again gets to speak with the greatest of all time, Jacqueline Coley. That certainly wasn't the case today as far as her co-host, because I am just Mark Ellis. You can get tickets for upcoming live shows, including DC, December 16th through the 19th. At markellis.live. That is @ that Jacqueline. And we are out of here. We'll see you next week, everybody.